Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, November 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. From the front page of the Gazette, the headline is Ban on Youth Sports Causes Confusion by Aaron Jordan. The Gazette youth sports programs, halted last spring because of COVID-19, have again been put on hold under a new proclamation from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. But some non-contact sports, including gymnastics, dance, and soccer, have asked for permission to continue because they say they are able to maintain social distancing, wear masks, and sanitize equipment. The proclamation, and now the waivers to exempt some, have created confusion among program leaders and parents. Quote, "It's been a real mess the whole week," said John Cook, director of coaching of the Iowa Soccer Club based in Iowa City. Reynolds' proclamation Tuesday prohibited, quote, "sporting or recreational activities of any size," unquote, except for high school, college, and professional sports. The order specifically called out close contact sports like wrestling and basketball as being off limits, but a statement from the governor's office also mentioned gymnastics, swimming, and dance. The proclamation went on to say sports could proceed if they kept participants and coaches 6 feet apart, limited spectators, and required masks for anyone besides the competing athletes. Quote, "A lot of us are doing these things already, which is why we were so shocked she singled us out," unquote, said Candace Van Hove, owner of the National Dance Academy in Cedar Falls. Before the dance studio reopened last summer, Van Hove marked off 6-foot by 6-foot squares on the floor, and her husband built portable ballet bars so dancers could use them in individual squares. Van Hove installed air scrubbers on the heating and air conditioning system and limited parents' access to the studio. If bars, restaurants, and casinos could open, Van Hove couldn't figure out why dance studios should be closed. Quote, "There is a big group of Iowa's dance studio owners who jumped on it," she said. "We started a petition and got lots of legal advice. As of Tuesday evening, we received an email from someone in the governor's legal office saying that, yes, we could still do dance classes," unquote. Twisters Gymnastics in Cedar Rapids canceled Wednesday classes over uncertainty about the proclamation. But then Thursday, it sent an email to parents announcing the classes would resume. Quote, "After some research and clarification, we were happy to find out that we can, in fact, continue," unquote, owner John Mangle wrote. The proclamation caused stress and anxiety for coaches, gymnasts, and parents, Mangle told the Gazette, and because youth sports haven't been identified as a source of community spread for COVID-19, the ban seemed unnecessary. Quote, "We mandated masks for all athletes in the gym while participating," he said. "We have 30 team kids work out in the same time period, but each has a group that stays exactly the same to eliminate any kind of contamination to another group," unquote. The Iowa Soccer Club's COVID-19 Advisory Committee, formed in May, decided Sunday to stop in-person indoor practices for now because of surging positive tests in Johnson County, Cook said. Quote, "We made a decision independent of the governor and independent of the proclamation," Cook said. "We'll be following just the science and the current conditions in our county," unquote. The club refunded tens of thousands of dollars of registrations for in-person soccer last spring, Cook said. Even with help from the Federal Paycheck Protection Program in April, May, and June, another prolonged shutdown will be hard on the club and the players. Quote, "Kids need exercise, especially during the winter months," Cook said. Some of the older soccer players sign up for virtual classes. Those practices have a lot of value, but it's all the hard parts, but none of the fun parts, unquote. Also from the front page, Solon determined to keep kids in class by Grace King. An anonymous group of parents is petitioning the Solon Community School District to join the increasing number of districts across the state seeking a waiver to move classes online temporarily. But district officials remain confident they can provide in-person instruction as safely as possible as COVID-19 surges. As of Wednesday, 165 students and 10 staff in the district were in quarantine. About 54 students were absent because of illness, and 10 or fewer of those had tested positive for COVID-19. No staff had tested positive for the coronavirus, although 5.5% of the staff were absent. Johnson County's 14-day positivity rate average was 14.1% on Thursday. For districts to qualify for virtual instruction under state rules, counties should have between a 15 and 20% 14-day positivity rate and student absences above 10%, not including students in quarantine. Band and choir was suspended until November 30th after 15 choir students were quarantined when a student tested positive. The 8th grade girls basketball team, a total of 20 students, also quarantined after one player tested positive. Solon is following guidance from the Iowa Department of Public Health about when to quarantine. It says that people who are in close contact with someone who has the disease do not need to quarantine if all involved were wearing masks correctly. As cases of COVID-19 began rising dramatically earlier this month, Superintendent Davis Eildahl said the district reopened a virtual learning option to families, but for now remains largely in person. About 20 students have taken the district up on that online offer, joining 80 students already enrolled in virtual learning since the start of the year. There are 1,500 students in the district. The 15 days students are back in the class between Thanksgiving break and the winter holiday will be crucial, Eildahl says. The administration is taking into account student and staff absences, the number of positive cases in the district, and indications of community spread within schools when considering virtual learning. Students out sick combined with students in quarantine is at 20%, Eildahl said. Quote, if we reach 30, that alone wouldn't close us, Eildahl said. But that combined with staff shortages might force a shift to the virtual, he said. As of Thursday afternoon, 55 school districts in Iowa had active waivers for virtual instruction from the Iowa Department of Education. The Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, College Community, and Clear Creek Amana school districts are all in temporary virtual learning until November 30th. Johnson County Public Health Community Health Manager Sam Jarvis said the Solon District is working closely with the department to make decisions about in-person learning. Quote, our stance has always been to be as supportive as possible for our schools. They're in a pretty impossible situation, unquote, Jarvis said. A small group of anonymous parents is asking the district to move to temporary virtual learning as cases of COVID-19 increase across the state. In an email to district officials and school board members Tuesday, shared with the Gazette, the parents asked the district to move to virtual learning as hospitals become overrun by COVID-19 patients. Quote, unfortunately, I'm not sure what to do with anonymous emails, said School Board President Tim Brown. Better if you're willing to put your name on it and have a conversation, unquote. Brown said he is concerned with the level of community spread in Johnson County and that hospitals are near capacity. Quote, we have to do those things we can to minimize the transmissions. Wear a mask, socially distance, and wash your hands, unquote, Brown said. The superintendent has the authority to request a virtual waiver. If he feels another waiver is necessary, he should consult with the school board, Brown said. Quote, we don't want to delay it by scheduling a special board meeting. We trust the superintendent to work with public health to make that determination if it's safe or not to stay in person, unquote. On Wednesday, a dozen Solon parents called the Gazette in support of keeping students in-person learning. Nicole Cunin, a parent of three elementary students in the Solon district, said that as a daycare provider at Solon Learning Academy, it would be, quote, overwhelming, unquote, to take on families in need of childcare if Solon went virtual. Her daughter, Capri, 7, who deals with severe anxiety, thrives on routine, Cunin said, and being back in school has helped her, she said. Cunin said her family has had to quarantine 6 times since the pandemic started in March, a total of 12 weeks. I've missed a lot of work, she said, but we've never been positive. I want to keep our schools open. It's so much more than just learning. It's their mental state. From page 2, University of Iowa selects interim to be business dean by Vanessa Miller. Amy Christoph Brown has been named dean of the University of Iowa Tippie College of Business. One of 6 finalists, Christoph Brown has been interim dean at the college since March 1st when Dean Sarah Gardiel left to lead the College of Business at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. Christoph Brown will be paid an annual salary of $450,000, up from her interim pay of $319,250. Gardiel, before leaving, was earning $314,781. I'm ready to lead Tippie to the next level as a destination business school for faculty, students, professionals, and lifelong learners, she said in a statement. Christoph Brown is a research professor of management and became senior data dean for the college in 2017. Christoph Brown joined Tippie as an assistant professor in the Department of Management and Organizations in 1997. She has a degree in psychology and business administration from the University of Richmond and a doctorate in organizational behavior and human resource management from the University of Maryland. A business dean search was led by a committee and assisted by external search firm Whitkiefer, which has been paid $154,485 to date for 2 rounds of finalists, one this summer and one this fall. UI Interim Provost Kevin Kriegel suggested Christoph Brown's leadership during the past 9 months gave her an edge. Quote, Dean Christoph Brown has demonstrated tremendous talent as an interim leader of Tippie, and I know she will continue to move the college forward as its permanent leader, Kriegel said in a statement. Mercy, Iowa City Breach Affects 60,000 by Michaela Ram. Dateline is Iowa City. Mercy, Iowa City is notifying more than 60,000 patients that their personal information may be at risk after an unauthorized user gained access to an employee's email account. Though the hospital has no reason to believe personal information has been used to commit fraud or identity theft, officials said this week they encourage patients to protect themselves. In a letter to the Iowa Attorney General's office, the law firm representing Mercy Iowa City said the hospital determined that 60,473 Iowans may be affected. Between May 15th and June 24th, an unauthorized third party gained access to an employee's email account. Mercy secured the account to prevent further access and launched an investigation with a forensic security firm. The account contained protected health information and personal information, including social security numbers. On November 13th, Mercy began sending written notices to affected patients. The notices include steps they can take to protect against fraud or ID theft. Quote, Mercy deeply regrets any concern or inconvenience this incident may cause its clients, unquote, a news release said, and went on, Mercy is reinforcing information security procedures with its employees and implementing changes to help prevent an incident like this from happening again, unquote. People can obtain information by calling 855-914-4658 toll-free from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. weekdays. Cedar Rapids Man Sentenced in Abusive Girl by Trish Mahaffey. A 22-year-old Cedar Rapids man was convicted Thursday for sexually abusing a 12-year-old girl and sentenced to up to 7 years in prison. 6th Judicial District Judge Sean McPartland accepted the plea and approved the sentencing in writing for Juwan J. Brown. He pleaded to 1 count of lascivious acts with a child and enticing a minor. During the pandemic, the Iowa Supreme Court is allowing written pleas and sentencings on felony charges if the defense and prosecution agree. According to the criminal complaint, the girl, during a forensic interview at the St. Luke's Child Protection Center, said Brown enticed her to come to a residence where he engaged in a sex act with her between January 15th and February 11th. The charges were amended from the original charge of third-degree sexual abuse and enticing a minor. When investigators questioned Brown, he admitted to the sexual abuse but claimed he was unaware of the girl's age. Investigators obtained text messages between Brown and the girl, which confirmed the girl's account. Brown was sentenced to 5 years on the lascivious acts charge and 2 years for the misdemeanor enticement charge, which will run consecutively for up to 7 years. He also must be on the sex offender registry and on special parole because this is a sexual offense for 10 years. Hinson seeks real-world input to aid her in Congress by James Q. Lynch. Continuing a practice she started as a member of the Iowa legislature, Congresswoman-elect Ashley Hinson is forming constituent advisory groups to give her, quote, real-world, unquote, feedback on issues she will deal with as a member of the U.S. House. Hinson, a Marion Republican who won the Iowa 1st District U.S. House race earlier this month, will be sworn in January 3rd as a member of the 117th Congress, succeeding Democrat Representative Abby Finkenauer in Cedar Rapids. Hinson said the advisory groups, or coalitions, will give residents an opportunity to advise her on what Congress should or shouldn't be working on. Quote, as things come up in Congress that I'm going to have to deal with and vote on, I need their real-world feedback as well, she said. It's a model, Hinson said, that served her well in 4 years in the Iowa House. For example, she said she reached out to Jones County Sheriff Greg Graver, for advice on animal protection laws the legislature was discussing. Hinson also sought input from Greg McGivern, a retired Linn County Sheriff's deputy, on law enforcement issues. Quote, as we were working on criminal justice reform in the House, I reached out to attorneys on both sides of an issue to figure out how they would actually implement those rule changes, unquote, Hinson said. When lawmakers are making decisions, quote, you should know how it's going to play out and impact people in their daily lives, she said. So that's the goal of the coalition, to help broaden my understanding of these issues, unquote. So far, Hinson has formed coalitions for farmers, veterans, moms, law enforcement, and small business. When she receives her committee assignments, Hinson said she may add more. First District residents don't have to be Republicans to join an advisory group. However, the sign-up page, AshleyHinson.com, join-a-coalition, on her website, explains that as a member, quote, you'll join other residents who share your values, because when we band together to support conservatism, we can do big things, unquote. Hinson has been isolating at home after testing positive for COVID-19. She has been cleared to travel, but continues to participate in congressional new members training virtually. It's a bit frustrating, she said, not being in Washington, D.C. to meet her new colleagues face-to-face. Quote, when you're a people person, you want to get out and have those conversations and develop relationships in person, unquote, Hinson said. From the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial, show us the real numbers. Incredibly, 8 months into the coronavirus pandemic, the state's data still lacks credibility. Last week, the Gazette's Aaron Jordan reported that the state's calculations for test positivity rates don't add up. Apparently, state officials are using a formula that includes numbers not available to the public, leading somehow to test positivity rates lower than those calculated with public data. Test positivity rates are important variables shaping public health policy. The higher the rates, the greater the community spread of the virus. For example, public schools can petition the state for permission to go to full online learning if the local test positivity rate tops 15%. Biostatisticians say the state's explanation for its calculations, that It is not counting multiple tests taken by an individual, but only one final test, doesn't make sense. This week, KCRG reported that the state is barring local public health departments from releasing data on capacity levels at local hospitals, data that would clearly illustrate the pandemic's impact on the healthcare system in cities and communities. The state only reports hospital capacity on a statewide and regional basis. This is part of an irresponsible pattern. In the spring, we learned that the state wouldn't report outbreaks at meatpacking plants unless asked directly for data by journalists. And when the state did report plant outbreaks, we learned that later that officials underreported case counts. In the summer, we learned the state was backdating positive COVID-19 test results to dates in the spring when an infected individual was first tested. The result was a skewed picture of rising caseloads and rising positivity rates. The state blamed a glitch in its aging computer system. This fall, Governor Kim Reynolds ordered public schools to return to in-person instruction in core subject areas. But the state is not reporting school outbreaks and doesn't require districts to report the data. In each instance, the inescapable conclusion is the Reynolds administration, through secrecy, omission, or glitch, sought to downplay the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic in Iowa. As the administration reopened the state, mandated a return to class, and resisted broader mitigation measures, officials didn't want worsening data to get in the way. To get the real picture, Iowans have turned to journalists and citizens, number crunchers, working around considerable barriers to get the real story. Iowans deserve to fully know the real numbers shaping life and death policy decisions. Their government has an obligation to provide that information. The Reynolds team must change course, release the data, and repair its tattered credibility. Now, Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column. Biden should go small on debt relief. President-elect Joe Biden is considering executive action on student debt relief in hopes of stimulating the economy. The idea is of great interest in Iowa, where public university tuition is set to rise next year. The state is in the top tier nationally for highest debt burden among college graduates, with almost two-thirds of the class of 2019 in Iowa holding debt of more than $30,000 on average, according to the Institute for College Access and Success. Americans' total student debt load, $1.6 trillion, more than we collectively owe on homes and cars, is a jarring figure, but erasing all of it is not good policy. Even by progressive standards, canceling student debt doesn't really add up. It would be a boon for middle and upper income Americans like me, not for poor Americans. Most student debt is held by the top half of income earners, and the lowest 20% of earners hold just 8% of it, according to a recent analysis from the left-wing People's Policy Project. And it's projected to be a meager economic stimulus. Jason Furman, an Obama-era Council of Economic Advisors chairman, recently wrote, quote, "It likely has a multiplier close to zero," unquote, since the forgiven amount would be taxable income. For several decades, state and federal governments have been on a mission to increase college enrollment, never mind the expected costs and benefits. They make it extremely easy to get into debt, but very difficult to get out. Young adults can take out loans regardless of whether their course of study might pay off, even if they go to sketchy colleges offering junk degrees. But it's uniquely difficult to discharge student loans through bankruptcy. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, two-time runner-up in the Iowa Democratic caucuses, campaigned on wiping out all student debt. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren calls for erasing most student debt, but would set limits on loan relief. Biden is unlikely to take up either suggestion. This week, he mentioned a $10,000 in loan forgiveness, a fraction of the Warren plan, but he will face pressure to go bigger. A narrow debt plan like Biden's may be worthwhile. Relief should be narrowly targeted at people who struggle to make payments, not blasted scattershot at well-off people who don't need it. People who took on little or no loan debt forwent post-secondary education or went to cheaper colleges, potentially limiting their earning potential for life. And people who have already paid off their debt, delayed making significant investments such as starting a business or buying homes. Many of them resent the idea of canceling loans. It's not because they are selfish or want others to be worse off. It's because they made real sacrifices and are tangibly worse off for it, and they want proportional compensation too. And what about the next generation of student debt holders and debt-burdened taxpayers? Student debt relief does nothing to control the skyrocketing cost of higher education, which outpaces inflation as measured by consumer price index. Biden has other college affordability plans, but they center on shifting the cost to the government rather than actually reducing cost. It's like getting a pedicure while your foot is consumed by a flesh-eating bacteria. Now, a letter to the editor by Gretchen Ree Robinson of Mount Vernon. Community Letters Officer gives insights, dismisses systemic racism. Thank you, Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette, for giving readers insight from Cedar Rapids Officer E.J. Merriweather. The Black officer and Cedar Rapids Police Union leader speaks up for peers, November 13th. The most profound comment Officer Merriweather said was, quote, "We don't fix the whole world, just the problem in front of us at the time," unquote. Sound advice for tough times and everyday concerns. What if the problem in front of us is how to define, quote, systemic racism, unquote? I would have liked to know what Officer Merriweather defines systemic racism to be, especially since he, quote, flatly says he doesn't believe systemic racism exists in law enforcement, locally or nationally, unquote. That's a broad statement. Believing something doesn't always make it so. The phrase systemic racism is now broadly used, and my concern is its definition isn't clear, broadly or not. And yet, we need law enforcement to fix the problems in front of us. I would suggest one problem is how thin the line is between systemic and not systemic. Iowans may be, quote, the most decent people around, unquote, according to Officer Merriweather. And yet, we still have problems. Some may be systemic. By Gretchen Ree Robinson, Mount Vernon. Iowa nears 200,000 cases of coronavirus, by Gage Miskimen. The Gazette Iowa on Thursday reported 4,193 new COVID-19 cases with a positivity rate of 40.17%. It was the ninth consecutive day Iowa has reported more than 4,000 new cases. It was the 16th day in a row the positivity rate has been 40% or above, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health data analyzed by the Gazette. Hospitalizations were down slightly from Wednesday's 1,527 to Thursday's 1,516 after increasing 11 days in a row. As of Tuesday, 113 Linn County residents, a record high, were hospitalized because of the virus. Of the new cases Thursday, 449 were among children up to age 18, and 9 were among workers in education. Since the pandemic began in March in Iowa, 198,687 cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed in the state. The state Thursday reported 38 additional deaths, bringing the death toll to 2,102. Polk County reported 5 deaths, and Grundy and Pottawatomie counties reported 3. Counties reporting 2 deaths each were Blackhawk, Cerro Gordo, Dubuque, Keokuk, Plymouth, and Scott. Counties reporting 1 death each were Appanoose, Buena Vista, Calhoun, Carroll, Cass, Clinton, Floyd, Ida, Jackson, Jasper, Jones, Marshall, Mills, Winnebago, and Wright. Linn County reported 262 new cases Thursday with a positivity rate of 33.72%. Those numbers are down from Wednesday's report of 336 new cases and a positivity rate of 45.22%. Lynn's 7-day average of new cases is 300. Its total number of cases since March is 12,474. Jones County added 53 cases with a positivity rate of 57.61%. The county's 7-day average is 56 new cases. Its total since March is 2,064. Johnson County added 136 virus cases with a positivity rate of 26.88%. Both numbers are up slightly from Wednesday's report of 126 new cases and a 25.55% positivity rate. Johnson's 7-day average is 124 new cases with 8,623 cases since March. Story County reported 171 new cases of COVID-19 and a positivity rate of 45.24%. Story's 7-day average is 105 new cases, and its total since March is 5,929. Blackhawk County reported 99 new cases and a positivity rate of 46.92%. The 7-day average is 177, with a total of 9,624. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, November 20th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Nicholas Holman, 80, died Wednesday, November 18th, 2020, Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, Cedar Rapids. From Independence, Donald D. Brown, 82, died Tuesday, November 17th, White Funeral Home, Independence. Also from Independence, Evelyn J. Hare, 79, died Monday, November 16th, 2020, Rife Family Center, Independence. Kyoto, Mary Ellen Henry, 77, died Tuesday, November 17th, 2020, Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Kyoto. Lansing, Dolores A. Shellhammer, 92, died Wednesday, November 18th, 2020, Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. Lansing, Bernice Walliser, 91, died Tuesday, November 17th, 2020, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Lansing. McGregor, James Schultz, 83, died Tuesday, November 17th, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, McGregor. Ossian, Cyril Bohr, 94, died Tuesday, November 17th, 2020, Schluter Ballack Funeral Home, Decorah. Toledo, Janet Marie Hosky Cavdera, 90, died Wednesday, November 18th, Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. Waukon, Daniel J. Hansmeyer, 88, of Waukon, formerly of Rochester, Minnesota, died Wednesday, November 18th, 2020, Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. And Mark Mask, 59, of Waterloo, died Friday, November 13th, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. Daniel Richard Bramow, Cedar Rapids. Daniel Richard Bramow, Cedar Rapids. Daniel Richard Bramow passed away on Friday, November 13th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha after a long fight with cancer and cirrhosis of the liver. As Daniel wished, his cremation has taken place, and a celebration of life honoring Daniel will take place in the spring along the Cedar River, where Dan spent countless hours. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. Elaine Therese Hansel, Cedar Rapids. Elaine Therese Hansel, 84, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, November 18th, at her home. There will be no public visitation. A private mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church, 1350 Lyndhurst Drive, Hiawatha, Iowa, with the Reverend Gary Mayer officiating. Burial will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. All invited guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Marion is assisting the family. Carolyn Harris, Cedar Rapids. Carolyn Harris, 31, of Marion, Iowa, passed away unexpectedly at home on Wednesday, November 11th. A private visitation will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home for her extended, also known as bonus, family and friends to bid Carolyn a blessed farewell. Please contact the family if you wish to attend. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people to be allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks is required. Charlie, Nicholas, Neil, Cedar Rapids. On Thursday, November 12th, 2020, Charlie Neal, husband, father, son, brother, and uncle, died in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, suddenly from COVID-19 at the age of 38. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, a private viewing will be held at Kramer Funeral Home on November 27th by invitation. A private service for immediate family will be held on November 28th and officiated by Father Paul Baldwin. Interment will follow at Sacred Heart Cemetery. Those attending the viewing or interment must practice social distancing and wear a mask. Please do not attend if you are feeling ill in any manner. We plan to hold a large celebration of Charlie's life when it is safe together again in large groups. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations in memory of Charlie may be made to his family through Kramer Funeral Home for his children's future or through their GoFundMe page. Online condolences may be left for the family at kramerfuneral.com. Patricia Walker Sweetman, 93, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, November 18th at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. A private memorial service will be held at a later date. Memorial contributions may be directed towards the family. Online condolences may be left at cedarmemorial.com. Robert Fred Dumbaugh, Hiawatha. Fred left this life at 3:55 a.m. on Sunday, November 15th, with his wife by his side. He released his body from the restricted effects of COPD and dementia. He is soaring now with the knowledge that he completed his time on Earth with no strings attached. Fred has donated his body to the University of Iowa. He requested no funeral. When his ashes are returned, we will gather for a celebration of life at his final resting place in West Lake, Okoboji, where all are welcome to attend. Please share your support and memories with Fred's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Condolences may be sent to 201 Tucker Street, Hiawatha, Iowa, 52233. Cheryl L. Irons, Marion. Cheryl L. Irons, 68, of Marion, died Wednesday, November 18th at the Ravenwood Nursing and Rehab in Waterloo. Per Cheryl's request, there will be no visitation or service. Iowa Cremation is in charge of arrangements. Lola Mae Fortner, Marion. Lola Mae Fortner, 77, of Marion, passed away on Wednesday, November 18th at her home in Marion, surrounded by her loving family. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, November 23rd at Mount Vernon Cemetery in Mount Vernon. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. A live stream of the graveside service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Lola under Photos and Videos or Media. Starting at 11 a.m. Monday, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. David E. Vogler, Masonville. David E. Vogler of Masonville passed away November 18th following a lifelong struggle with diabetes and COVID-19. Services will be held at a later date. William Bill Grange, Mount Vernon. William Bill Grange, 68, of Mount Vernon, passed away peacefully Tuesday, November 17th, at Hospice House, Hiawatha, after a short illness. There will be no services at this time. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon is caring for Bill and his family. Memorials may be directed to Mount Vernon Lisbon Ambulance. Please share your support and memories with Bill's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Gregory J. Berkey, Newton. Gregory J. Berkey, 69, of Newton, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died on Tuesday, November 17th at his home in Newton. A celebration of Greg's life will be held at a later date. Memorials to Mercy Hospice can be left at the Wallace Family Funeral Home and Crematory in Newton. Thomas Theobald, Olwine. Thomas Theobald, 99, of Olwine, passed away on Monday, November 16th at Mercy One Senior Care in Olwine. Visitation will be private. Public funeral services will begin at 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 23rd at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Olwine, with Father Ray Atwood officiating. Interment will be held in Woodlawn Cemetery at Olwine. A memorial fund has been established. For condolences, please visit gellenfeldfh.com. Due to state and federal guidelines on gatherings regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, social distancing is required. Those in attendance are required to wear a mask. Evelyn Eliza Montgomery, Waupaca, Wisconsin. Evelyn Eliza Montgomery, 79, was granted her angel wings on Tuesday, November 17th. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, November 24th, at the Dunkard Cemetery in Toddville, Iowa. The Holly Funeral Home of Waupaca is assisting the family with arrangements. Vernon Cohn, 85, of Victor, Iowa, died on Thursday, November 19, 2020, at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. A public funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, November 23rd, at St. James Lutheran Church in Victor. A face mask will be required to those attending the service. Interment with military honors will follow at Victor Memorial Cemetery. Due to COVID-19 restrictions limiting funeral receptions, no reception will be held. A public visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday at the Smith Funeral Home in Victor. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, the family will not be present, and the visitation will be limited to 15 people at a time. A face mask will be required for those attending the visitation. Memorials may be designated to St. James Lutheran Church and mailed in care of the Smith Funeral Home, P.O. Box 485, Victor, Iowa, 52347. Memories and condolences may be shared with Vernon's family online at smithfh.com. Now, turning to the sports page. High School Football Class A Championship. Regina Blitz's Grundy Center claims school's 8th state championship, by K.J. Pilcher. Iowa City Regina's seniors grew up amid the program's run of multiple state football championships. The goal was to one day hoist a title trophy of their own. After 4 years, three trips to the Unidome, and 2 final appearances, these Regals are number one again. Quote, "We've kind of grown up with all the state championship games," Regina senior quarterback Ashton Cook said. "Best is the standard. That's what we say in our program. We like to hold ourselves to that, and to have won a state championship means a lot," unquote. Second-ranked Regina erupted for 24 unmatched points in the second quarter. Alec Wick and Theo Coley set title game records, and the Regals rolled to a 52-28 victory over number one Grundy Center in the Class A championship game on Thursday. Regina claimed their 8th state crown and first since 2015. Quote, "You always want to go out with a bang, and that's what we did," said Wick, who broke the Class A championship game with 226 receiving yards. "We executed every play, and we never let up," unquote. All three facets contributed, and a gamble paid off in a critical 17-point flurry in a 4-minute, 15-second stretch on the second, allowing the Regals to pull away from the Spartans. Wick's 22-yard field goal sparked the rally, putting Regina ahead 10-7. Due to the fact that Grundy Center's previous drive covered 80 yards on 13 plays and burned a little more than 6 minutes off the clock, Regina coach Marv Cook opted to try an onside kick. Jack Clark recovered the ball, and 5 plays later, Coley scored his second of a championship game record 5 rushing TDs. This time was a 1-yard run for a double-digit Regina advantage. "We know we have an offense that can score at any time," Ashton Cook said. "When we got that onside, it was huge." Coley provided a big play defensively to go with his 124 rushing yards. He rushed off the end and drilled Grundy center quarterback Logan Knack, jarring the ball free that Jack Tierney returned to the Spartans 25. "I saw the end crash down and I was like, oh, thank you. So I just went out there," Coley said. Coley added another 1-yard score, and his 5-yard run with 47 seconds left gave Regina a 31-7 halftime lead and tied the record of 4 that was shared by 3 others. His 4-yard TD run early in the fourth put him in the record books. The Regals amassed 534 total yards. The younger Cook finished with 325, completing 17 of 24 passes and second-half TD strikes to Carson Jensen for 12 and Wick for 88. The Spartans suffered a huge loss during that second quarter barrage. Leading rusher Zach Opheim left with a back injury on the first play after the onside kick. He missed the last 9 minutes of the first half and all of the second half. Knack passed for 262 yards and 2 TDs and ran for 2 more, and Nick Asher had 214 receiving yards and a score for Grundy Center. The victory was a crowning achievement for the Regina seniors that were in the title game as freshmen. They have a title of their own. Quote, "Each team is unique," Marv Cook said. "Each group of seniors, it's their class and their team. I've coached these guys since kindergarten in all the different sports. It's fun to watch these guys play. These guys can play flat out." The next story is Waukon Within 1 Win of Goal by Jeff Linder. The Gazette for many teams. Waukon Within 1 Win of Goal by Jeff Linder. For many teams, a postseason injury to a starting quarterback would mean curtains for certain, not Waukon. Instead of sinking, the Indians plugged on without Creed Welch last week. The reward is one more game, a championship opportunity. Fourth-ranked Waukon plays in its third Class 2A final in the last 4 years, and its fourth since 2013 when it faces number 3 Central Lion George Little Rock today. Kickoff is at 2 p.m. at the Unidome. "I'm really, really proud of the way the kids responded last week," Waukon coach Chad Bierman said. The Indians were rolling offensively in the first half, leading number 1 Monroe PCM 16-7, and on the march again when Welch, a 3-year starter, went down with both knee and ankle injuries to his left leg. Quote, "When he got tackled, his foot got pinned under the guy and then he got rolled on," Bierman said. "It's probably good that both the knee and the ankle were impacted instead of just one of them taking all of the impact. Creed wanted to come back in, but we thought we had things under control, unquote. Sean Cooper entered at quarterback and completed the drive with an 11-yard touchdown to Avery Roxfold. Then Waukon replied on 2 fourth-quarter touchdowns by Ethan O'Neill and an inspired defensive effort to finish off the 38-21 victory. The question now, will Welch be ready for the championship game? The answer? Quote, "We think he'll be able to play," Bierman said. "He's pretty sore and he hasn't practiced yet, but we don't believe there's any ligament damage. We'll get a brace on him for extra support," unquote. Under offensive coordinator Jed Heman, the Indians' multi-weapon attack has yielded 42.1 points and 377 yards per game. "Bierman has given me free rein to do what I thought was best," Heman said. "He's always sending me stuff to see if it might work for us. But the big thing is that we have good athletes. We've got a very good offensive line. They're not overly big, but they are fast and physical." Welch has passed for 14 touchdowns and has rushed for 11. O'Neill ran for 192 yards and 3 touchdowns against PCM, upping his season totals to 1,098 yards and 19 TDs. The receiving group is balanced with four guys between 200 and 350 yards. The CLGLR, the Indians will be facing a team. It looks a lot like us, Bierman said. They're pretty run-heavy, and a lot goes through their quarterback, Zach Lutmer. Their line isn't huge, but their guys are up front and really athletic. While Khan won the 2A championship in 2017 and was the runner-up in 2013 and 2019. Our general feeling was that we didn't show up and give our best effort last year, Bierman said. We had too many penalties and turnovers. We need to be sharp and focused today. Fitting end for Cook and Wick by K.J. Pilcher. Dateline Cedar Falls. It was a final fitting touchdown. Ashton Cook and Alec Wick stepped to the line of scrimmage. Eventually, the senior signal caller pointed downfield and launched a throw that only his most popular record-setting receiver could get. The play resulted in an 88-yard touchdown pass with little more than 8 minutes remaining to cement a rock-solid lead in second-ranked Iowa City Regina's 52-28 victory over number one Grundy Center for the Class A state football championship Thursday afternoon in the Unidome. The play was the last connection of one of the most prolific passing tandems in Iowa high school football. Cook ended with a Class A best 2,862 passing yards this season and 25 TDs. Wick accounted for 1,401 of those yards and 16 TDs. Both were tops in 11-player classes. It's been amazing playing with him since elementary school, Cook said of Wick. We've just developed such good timing. I know where he's going to run. That last play, we had a miscommunication. He was on the sideline, so I threw that ball out there. I knew he was going to be able to run under it. Wick closed his career with a pair of records. He set a new Class A championship game record with 226 receiving yards, breaking the old mark of 163 set by Frederick Berg's Jason Steig in 2001. His game-high 9 receptions also gave him the 242 career catches, which is a new state record. He finished with 3,655 career receiving yards, which ranks third all-time. Those feats were the furthest thing from his mind. I really don't care, Wick said. We just won state, and that's all I'm focused on. Multiple times over the last 4 years, Cook scrambled, signaled to Wick in mid-route, who found space for Cook to deliver a ball only Wick could catch. Quote, Alec and Ashton putting the ball in the right spot and only one guy can get it, Regina coach Marv Cook said, and that guy is Alec Wick. He's able to make great plays for us. It was a great way to finish off. Today's state championship game, Class 2A championship, number 4 Waukon versus number 3 Central Lion GLR. Kickoff 2 p.m. at the Unidome in Cedar Falls. Here's the postseason path. Waukon hasn't had a game go down to the wire yet in the postseason. The Indians began with lopsided wins over Forest City, 56-14, and Monticello, 46-14, and then was able to grind out a 24-8 quarterfinal win over number 6 Solon. They scored 2 late touchdowns to pull away from number 1 Monroe PCM 38-21 in the semifinals. CLGLR's toughest test came in the second round, 34-27 over Unity Christian. The Lions followed with triumphs over Esterville ELC 28-6, number 5 West Lion 34-13, and number 9 Comanche 41-0. Key players. Both teams have multi-threat quarterbacks. Creed Welch is expected to play for Waukon after suffering ankle and knee injuries in the semifinals. Welch has passed for 14 touchdowns and had run for 11 more with 1,835 total yards. Ethan O'Neill has added 1,098 yards on the ground with 19 touchdowns. Lincoln Snitker is the leading receiver. 19 catches, 329 yards, 6 TDs. and he also anchors the Indians' defense with 62.5 tackles and 4 interceptions. For CLGLR, quarterback Zach Lutmer has accounted for 29 touchdowns, 21 rushing, 8 passing. He has run for 1,508 yards and has passed for 1,083. Cooper Spiess leads the Lions receiving corps with 16 catches for 346 yards. Spiess and Lutmer have 4 interceptions apiece, with Lutmer returning 2 of them for touchdowns. Finals history. Waukon has reached the championship game for the 4th time, all in the last 8 years. The Indians won the 2A title in 2017 and were runners-up in 2013 and 2019. CLGLR is in the final for the first time since 2008. The Lions were champions in 2006 and runners-up 5 times. Before the football merger, Central Lion won 2A titles in 1976 and 1977. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, November 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.